This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Eleanor Spicer Rice has built a career around the stuff that some people might consider gross. She studies bugs and writes books about them, including her series about the common ants and spiders found in your own backyard. Eleanor has been fascinated by nature her whole life, and as a little girl growing up in Greensboro, she spent tons of time outside, wandering around the swamps outside of town. She loved insects, but she didn't realize that they could be a career until she went to college. She got her undergraduate and doctorate degrees at NC State, and today she is a science writer, in addition to being an entomologist. Eleanor Spicer Rice joins me in studio now. Welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you, Anita. So great to be here. I do need to say, though, I'm from Goldsboro, just in case you wanted to know, because Goldsboroans are a very proud people.
Did I say Greensboro?
They might not want to be mixed up, but I'm so glad to be here.
Goldsboro, yes, that's what I have written here. So that was my eyes crossing. Well, tell me about Goldsboro and what it was like to grow up there.
Oh, it was wonderful for me growing up in Goldsboro. It's a great and nurturing town full of a lot of natural spaces and a lot of time to read, if you want to read. And so for me, and growing up with my family was a wonderful place to grow up.
So you had two parents who encouraged you to spend time outside. They didn't discourage you from being mucky and hanging out with maggots. Tell me about that.
Oh, no. Both of my parents, my mama, Catherine, is an English teacher at Wayne Community College. And she loved British literature. And she loved the romantic idea of being outside. And my father was very natural, James. He just loved us, the outdoors, and loved to observe the outdoors. And so my mom would give me my breakfast crumbs to go feed the ants on the curb in the morning and watch the ants and wonder about them. And my dad would take us out into the swamp and look around and just see what we could find out there.
Tell me about the swamp. You have a particular memory, formative memory, out in the swamp with your dad.
Yeah. So growing up, I didn't know that there was anything called entomology growing up. I just knew that I liked animals, and insects are animals, and there are a bunch of them. So if you like animals, insects are great because you'll always be surrounded by something that you like. And one time we were walking out in the swamp, and there was a turkey vulture just floating across the water, and it was dead. And I've never seen a turkey vulture up close before. You always see them flying up in the sky, right? And so it had that red head that kind of looks like a rooster's comb, but it's this whole head and those oily, beautiful black feathers. And it was so clean looking. And I walked over to it and I lifted up its feathers, and it was teeming with thousands of creatures crawling on it and eating it because it was dead. And it was wonderful for me because nobody ever said that I cared about, ever said, don't touch that. That's gross. You know, nobody ever said that to me. So I was able to form my own opinions about what this was. And to me, it was beautiful because you have this dead thing that made a living off of eating dead stuff, you know, and now it's turning into thousands of living things. And I had so many questions from it because here are these things that don't have wings, these grubs or whatever it could have been, maggots, living in this thing that's floating in the middle of the swamp. How did they get there? And they're mixed in. How are they interacting with all of these other things? I didn't know then. I mean, I know now, but I didn't know then how this happened. And it was wonderful, and that inspired wonder in me. It was amazing to me that this was going on right here on this one bird right here in the middle of the swamp.
Did you have any fear? Because I can imagine, first of all, I would never have lifted up the wing to see the maggots underneath. But if I had, then I'd seen them, I would have jumped far away.
I did not have any fear about that, just because I've always followed insects and I've always watched them. And when you come into something naturally and you know something, you know what you should be frightened of and what you can be frightened of. And you know what's totally harmless. So even if you don't know that a maggot isn't going to hurt you that's floating in the middle of a swamp, if you're in your yard and you spend enough time out there, you're going to come in contact with maggots. You'll know what is not going to hurt you. And so you can put things together in a natural way that way. So you know what to be afraid of and what not to be afraid of.
Did you have any pets as a kid? And what was your relationship with these animals in nature As in, like, a lot of kids want to kind of collect them and put them in a jar and then take them inside the house. Was that an instinct of yours?
It's true. And I am sad that that was an instinct of mine. Many things have died under my terrible, awful inability to take care of them. So, you know, there are roly-polies, ghosts are haunting me probably to this day, and fireflies. And when you wonder about things, sometimes you harm them because you don't know how to handle them. And we had real pets. We had dogs and cats and birds, and they were great, and they did not suffer the fate of many insects that I just didn't know how to take care of that I do now.
When did you first start storing bugs in a freezer or keeping them beyond their expiration dates?
Oh, do they ever expire? I don't know. I think I've always kind of put them in the freezer. If you keep them out long enough, they'll rot or somebody will eat them. But if you put them in the freezer, they'll last a long time. And, you know, I would do it as a child. And I found out later as an entomologist, as a person going to graduate school for entomology, that's just what you do. You stick them in the freezer until you can examine them or until you can pin them to preserve them, because they dry out pretty quickly, or, you know, they'll start to smell.
So you were clearly a very unique kid, full of curiosity. What was your experience in Goldsboro itself, going to school there?
I did not know that I was a unique kid. I thought that everybody had, you know, something that they were interested in. And I do believe that most people are interested in things that, when you get to talking about them, it might sound weird to other people. But nobody ever really that I cared about ever told me that I was strange, you know. So growing up and going to school, it was fine. People were nice about it, I guess. I didn't know they were being nice about it. I thought that people liked things as much as I did. And I didn't know until later that it was weird. So it was, for growing up, was totally fine in terms of being a small entomologist in a town where you'd have no idea that entomology is a thing.
Tell me about your love of literature and how you got interested in the Harlem Renaissance in particular. You were a middle schooler, I think, interested in the Harlem Renaissance.
Oh,
is that right?
That's true. That is true. And when I was little, my mother loves poetry and she loves words. And the schools that I went to growing up, most of the people that I went to school with did not have the advantages that I had growing up. Many people did not have very much money. And not that we had a lot of money, but they had no money, you know. I mean, and they had a lot of other issues that they had to wake up with every morning that I didn't have to wake up with. So my mom started reading me these poems in an attempt to get me to help understand what people during times of segregation or were going through, so that I could understand what it takes to wake up and just be a human in the daytime. And I loved them. I mean, in addition to the content of them, the rhythms of them and the ideas behind these things are so inspiring, and they really help to connect you with other people that you don't know or you haven't met before. And a lot of them are really easy to read for a middle schooler. So it's great to read, you know, Dudley Randall or, you know, all these people that are writing about events that you've never seen before, but you can really hit home to you, you know? So that's what happened with the Harlem Renaissance. I was fascinated by it.
Did you, from an early age, have a sense that your mind worked differently when you were reading literature based on your experience and your curiosity with science? Did that connect at an early age?
No, I think that your mind works in a very similar way with literature and with science. I feel like literature and science both seek to find the truth. They both look for meaning, and they both have... There's a lot of themes and patterns to things that you have to follow. There's a tremendous amount of creativity involved in science, reading comprehension. These things work process. Literature has a lot of process. You have to learn how to write paragraphs. You learn the heroic cycle. You learn the way books unfold. And science has its own process. And these things blend together very well when you start looking at them. And they complement each other. Great scientists are often great readers and good writers. And, you know, and a lot of people who are interested in literature also are interested in science. And because these things blend so well together.
I know that you may have not had as much of a knack for math, though, as a elementary school.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, I'm just saying what I read.
Yeah, I was terrible at it. Thank you for Googling that. I appreciate it. I was awful at math. I didn't like it at all. I didn't like math until I started graduate school and realized that if I put these numbers down and, you know, could calculate wonderful things, how much pollen a bee has on its body, you know, the way that the chemicals come off of an ant, you know, these things that I didn't understand how practical and beautiful math was at the time. I had zero interest in it whatsoever.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation with Eleanor Spicer Rice. She's an entomologist and a science writer. Just ahead, we're going to talk about her time in college when she realized bugs could be a career. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stachow. Eleanor Spicer Rice grew up in Goldsboro and was captivated by the bugs in her backyard. She spent countless hours outside observing nature, but she didn't understand that she could turn all of that love into a career until she got to college at NC State. Today, she's an entomologist and a science writer and my guest in studio. So I want to get to NC State in a minute, but I want to talk about high school and a formative experience that you had when you were driving back from the beach, I believe.
That's true. Yeah, Goldsboro is near enough to the beach that you don't have to have a beach house. You can get down there in an hour or so and come back. And one morning, one of my best friends, Robin, and I were coming home from the beach, and there was a man in the middle of the road when I was about 17. And we didn't know what was wrong with him. And then we could see farther down the road that a large truck had stopped, and we realized that he was dying, and he had fallen into the truck. And Robin and I had both been certified just recently to be lifeguards, so we felt like we knew what to do. If you needed help, we were there to help, but he was missing parts of himself that he needed to survive. Mm-hmm. And so this is before cell phones, and there's not a hospital near where we were. And so basically we were there with him while he was dying. And it bothered me a lot. And it bothered me for a number of reasons, but two things that really bothered me about it was, first, just the idea of watching this person turn in from a human into a bunch of cells and a bunch of tissue, that watching somebody die was very disturbing to me. And the other thing that really bothered me about it was that he was going through this extremely vulnerable and private, the most private thing that can happen to any person is to die. And he was going through it surrounded by strangers. Hmm. And there were people driving by pointing at him and laughing because they didn't know what was happening. And It was very disturbing to me. And so what happened right after that was that I got chosen by the county, to Wayne County, to go to a program that North Carolina has called Governor School, which is a fantastic program. It was started by Governor Terry Sanford. We are the first state to ever have a governor school, and it's a wonderful place where people who have interest can thrive in their interest around other people who share those interests. And so I went for English because that was my interest in school. And they help you to got your, first of all, it was 6 weeks. It's the longest I've ever been away home from my family. And it was the longest I've ever been away from home, mm-hmm. other than when I would go visit my mama's parents in Alabama in the summertime. So you can look back in a way you've never been able to look back before on your county, and you can get perspective that you can't get when you're surrounded by people you love. And Governor School helps you to think about things like, what's truth? I mean, well, why would you think about that before? What's meaningful? And, you know, how can you do what's right, even when authority tells you or society tells you something else is right? And so I was rewriting this man's story, this horrible thing that I saw, from the self-absorbed perspective of a teenager. What if that was me that happened to? I don't know this man. I don't know who cried for him when he died. But what if it was me? Or what if it was my mama? Or what if it was my friend Robin who was in the car? What would it take for that not to be the thing that mattered? For that to be something that happened and not the thing that happened to him? And so at Governor School, they work you through this kind of self-exploration and mental discovery. And I came out of that with these two very simple imperatives on life. And the first is that you should love people, and you should be loved by people. And you should know people. It's important to know people and to love the people you know. And the other imperative is that you should be able to find your interest and your talents and use those to help yourself and to help other people. And I use those two ideas to make decisions for the rest of my life. I don't know what it says that I've the 17-year-old me kind of guides the way that I move through the world, but those two concepts are the way that I make decisions on how I move forward in my career. And when I check in with them, things go pretty well if I consider the people I love and you know, consider if this is helping other people. And then sometimes they don't go so well if you don't check in with those decisions. So that's what happened.
So you developed this, I mean, what could be considered like your own version of a gut instinct? Like, these are the things that I need to check in with myself about to guide me in my next decision that I'm going to make.
Right.
But then at the point you decided that the best decision for you would be to stay in Goldsboro and work at Walmart instead of
going off to college.
Well, so what led you to that?
Well, in high school, I was working at a veterinarian's office, and I had quit my job because it was almost time to go to college, you know, and everybody's going to college, and I didn't really want to go to college. So this shows you just my great genius thinking as a teenager. I wanted to stay at home and live with my parents and read all day because I like to read. And my mom said, that's great, you can do that, but all your friends are going to go to college and you're going to get really lonely if you're at home here and they're all out in school. So I was like, okay, that's great. So I applied to NC State and UNC, and I got into both, so that I just counted up how many friends I had going to NC State and how many going to UNC, and I had one more going to State. So I went to State, and that was one of the best decisions I never made in my life. So it ended up being a wonderful place for me.
So you get to NC State, and you begin to realize that this passion for bugs is something that you can actually turn into a career. Tell me about discovering that.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't know that there was a real thing of entomology as a career. And this guy in my first class at NC State knew so much about insects. And I said, how do you know about all these bugs? And he said, come down to the museum downtown, the Museum of Natural Sciences, on Wednesday, and I'll show you. So I went down on Wednesday, and I went up to the fourth floor to this place called the Arthropod Zoo, and I banged on the door, and a man named Bill Reynolds answered the door. Bill Reynolds is still the curator of the Arthropod Zoo down there. And he took me into the zoo. He showed me all of the arthropods. Arthropods are anything like millipedes or centipedes or you know, anything with an outside skeleton.
So this is
shell.
A zoo for insects.
That's what it's called. Yeah. You can go visit it today if you'd like to. It's up there. There's a lot of wonderful creatures up there for you to see. And he would show me the breadth of insects that are there. And he let me come every Wednesday and feed the insects. And he would teach me things about like speciation, you know, the way that different species are and the different. And one night he took me out collecting when I was just learning. And he took me out to collect so we could put stuff on display for the museum. And we would go to Fuquay Varina, which at the time was getting paved over for to put up, you know, people to live there. You know, it was becoming a commuting community. And so we would go to these car lots that people had paved over and put in the middle of trees. And so car lots have really bright lights. And so these lights are like the brightest moon any insect has ever seen in their life. So they all come out of the trees and they go to these car lots. And the first time we went, it's like I'd been living half of a life. And I had no idea about these things that came out of the trees. You know, I mean, stag beetles, Hercules beetles, moths as big as your hands, and they're everywhere, leopard moths. I mean, it was like a tropical forest, but it's here, it's right here, and we're living with this. And I had no idea how beautiful everything was around me at night. I knew in the day it was amazing, but the whole world just turned into this magical place where there was anything was possible. And you have all these questions. You have these giant moths we're living with right now. What are those caterpillars like? What are they doing up in the trees? I mean, there's so many questions that you come up with when you're looking at this magical world that we all, every single one of us, is living in right here because we are lucky enough to be here in North Carolina.
You have so much passion and excitement when you talk about this topic. And I wonder for you, I mean, after that day of experiencing this, how did it change how you saw the world when you're just walking around, getting coffee, doing normal everyday things?
Oh, well, insects or loving anything in the natural world will change your world. It'll change anybody's world. This was a car lot, you know, in Fuquay Varina. When I was a child, I had a log in my backyard with this giant leopard slug on it and all these little, you know, these little bark lice and stuff. I mean, everywhere you look, something is alive and it's around you and it's doing something wonderful. And to know what it is, it enhances every single thing you do in life. Walking into this studio this morning, I saw pavement ants coming out from the sidewalk eating somebody's gum. And I know where they came from and I know where they're going. And I know how they set up these colonies every year by having these giant battles and they have territories, you know. And I saw these beautiful leaf hoppers on the trees right outside in the parking deck. There are patterns on these leaf hoppers and the shapes of them are they're almost impossible when you look at them. And they're right here and we walk past them and around them every day. And when you see these things and you know these things, they become your friends. And the world, the whole world opens up and can become your friend just by watching the things around you.
How do you, when you look back on that traumatic experience that you had as a 17-year-old of watching someone pass away and have this private moment all alone, and then you have this ability to observe the natural world in this, you know, the true circle of life, how do you bring those two things together? How does the natural world impact how you make sense of the hard parts of human experience?
Well, the hard parts of human experience are a part of human experience. And the best that we can do is find meaning in our daily lives. I really believe that if you do good things, you work hard, and you help people, and you love people, you're doing great. And if you do what you love, you're doing great. And so I have the luxury of being able to do what I love. Not everybody has that luxury, but I feel like the natural world help. They work together. And for me, the natural world is very comforting. I cannot control the natural world. I can't control hard things happening. But I can predict the natural world. I can predict that when I drop popcorn in my driveway, these ants are going to come and carry it off in the most charming way possible. And I can predict when we find cicadas that have just come out of the dirt this summer and I put them on a tree, a beautiful winged creature is going to come out of that shell and fly away. And it happens. And these things that I'm predicting are happening have happened for millions of years. They've happened since the dinosaurs were here. And that is a wonderful, wonderful thing to me. And it really helps us to understand our place as humans in the world. You know, we have a tremendous amount of impact on the world that we're living in right now, but we haven't been here very long. If you take the timeline of the earth from the formation of life on the earth to humans and you put it on a yardstick, humans would be a hair's breadth on that yardstick. A hair's breadth. You couldn't divide it enough to see how tiny you and I are on there, right? But insects have been there for millennia. And it's wonderful to see these things that you know, I'm watching things that T-Rex has watched or whatever. It's great and it's beautiful.
So you get to NC State, you fall in love with this arthropod zoo, you decide to continue your quest to study this. You eventually end up getting your PhD in entomology.
I did.
Tell me about what you chose to study. I guess, when did you start working with honeybees? Was that during your master's?
It was during my master's.
Okay.
And I have to say that it's very lucky of me to have chosen NC State as a school because they happen to have one of the greatest entomology departments in the country and one of the greatest entomology departments on the planet. So they have people, when I first got there, they have people like Kobe Shaw, Jules Silverman, Ed Vargo, Fred Gould, you know, Mike Waldvogel. These are people who have Clyde Sorensen, who are the best in the fields at what they're doing, either educating or making discoveries that have tremendous impacts on people's lives. And I didn't know that at the time. But what I did know was that there's this whole floor of really, really nice people who just let you in and show you stuff. And that's a gift. That's a gift that these people have given, and they'll do it for anybody. Even today, I call them and ask them questions all the time. And they're so kind about it, and they bring it back. So, I mean, our state schools have just done these wonderful things for me in learning. I studied honeybees, to answer your question, in Georgia.
Well, so tell me about that, because I know that was an interesting introduction to you of the divide between the general public and the scientific world.
Right,
because there was some skepticism of some of the beekeepers you were meeting with.
Right. So, yeah, I got one of the lucky things for me is that the two things I chose to study are two things that people are very intertwined with. So for my master's, I studied bees, native bees, and honeybees. Honeybees are not native to the United States, by the way. And we have more than 500 species of native bees here in North Carolina alone. That some of them have very specific pollination. The bees are just, they're fascinating. But I would get to talk to beekeepers, and I would see that I would tell the beekeepers something that I knew from reading, you know, peer-reviewed research on it. And they wouldn't believe me because they had their own ideas of why, my motives for saying those things. And I also could see that the beekeepers were really, really bright people who had these wonderful ideas. And sometimes they weren't quite right because they were just missing a little piece of information that I got to learn because I had the luxury of watching bees all day and studying bees all day. So I could see that there was a little bit of a mistrust and a disconnect between the general public and their knowledge of what's going on and then the scientists and their knowledge of what's going on. So that kind of stuck with me as I went to go get my PhD in ants, which are also very closely associated with humans. This is urban entomology, right? So these are the ones so I could see, you know, talking to people, and people call me all the time to ask me questions about ants. And sometimes I just see a little general mistrust. And so while I was getting my PhD, I thought, well, I could help bridge this gap because I've learned these things and I can tell people about these things.
What do you think leads to the mistrust? Is it fear? Is it kind of human arrogance?
No, I don't think it's – no. I mean, I do think fear is part of it because a lot of people don't know about insects or the creepy crawlies of life. And part of it is that we're just missing knowledge pieces. And part of it is that historically, and I don't think this is as true today, but historically, scientists have not been super great communicators. We don't want to be wrong. We want to say every single thing that leads to every single fact. And nobody cares but you. It's like telling somebody your dream. If I told you what my PhD research was on, you'd be like, thanks, I don't care. You know, but if you can distill it to the information and keep it accurate that people care about, then I think that you can build this bridge together.
So when you came back to North Carolina and you started your PhD at NC State, you were reading some headlines and newspapers and magazines that got you thinking about more about this mistrust. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you read about people, you know, hooray, we killed a snake. This is great, you know, and it's really not that great to go out and kill your snakes. I mean, there's a guy out in Auburn who was thinking, okay, he studied snakes at the time. And he's like, copperheads seem like they're on the rise. Everybody's calling me about copperheads. And he went out and looked around and saw that king snakes are declining in populations. Well, king snakes eat copperheads. King snakes are also easier to see than copperheads and more likely to be killed by humans than copperheads. You know, just seeing a snake and killing it does not make you very heroic. It actually means that you could be having these catastrophic or, you know, ripple effects across the population of snakes in your yard that ends up hurting you.
So there's a way that some science is communicated in a way that, like, I guess scare tactics are used.
Yeah,
essentially.
Some people use scare tactics and stuff, and it, you know, that's just the way. And I don't think it's the same now as it was when I first started. I think there, that's what happens with science communication sometimes. But there are a lot of great science communicators. I didn't know that science. It's just like I didn't know, you know, entomology was a field. I didn't know science communication was a field either. I came into this totally blind. So I was writing articles for the NC State newspaper, The Technician. I was writing articles for the News and Observer and, you know, practicing on finding what's important to say. And since then, I've met tons of wonderful and dedicated science communicators who are working really hard.
We're going to continue our conversation about science communication and all of the work Eleanor continues to do here in North Carolina when we continue our conversation with entomologist and science writer Eleanor Spicer Rice. Just ahead, we'll also talk about a project she's working on to identify brown recluses or not. It's on Twitter. It's called Recluse or Not. You can check it out as we continue our conversation. Stay with us. I'm Anita Rao. This is The State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stacio. When Eleanor Spicer Rice got her PhD in entomology, she imagined she'd end up working in a lab for a big chemical company. But while her love of science was strong, she couldn't ignore her passion for writing. Her work freelancing for newspapers and magazines eventually led her to start her own writing company with a childhood friend. Today, Eleanor is a science writer and an entomologist who has fused these passions into a career. So, Eleanor, we talked a bit about kind of this bridge between science and the general public. And for you, it's really important to bridge science and the arts. And you're interested in kind of expanding people's understanding of STEM to STEAM.
Right.
So tell us about that.
STEM is kind of a buzzword right now for science, technology, engineering, and math. And there are we know for sure that there's disparity in the way that people look at coming into STEM fields. And so we have it's a largely white field, and for a long time it was mostly men. We're working making a lot of progress with gaining parity with women in STEM fields, gaining bachelor's degrees at least. The hurdles to working in STEM fields are still kind of tricky, but something I think and as far as historically underrepresented minorities go, we still have a long way to go in bringing people into STEM, but another thing that I feel is important and that is overlooked is the role of art in science, technology, engineering, and math. Because so some people put an A in there and call it STEAM, you know, and that's kind of cute for some people. It drives some people crazy, but I think it's cute. And the thing about STEAM is that we've been ignoring for a while some very important pieces of what it takes to make a great scientist or great engineer, and that is art, because it takes, you have to know, have a lot of reading comprehension. You have to have a lot of creativity. You have to have a tremendous amount of knowledge of history and social studies. And these things come together to enhance the way that you are able to do your work. My husband is an engineer, and he's also a great musician. And these things blend together. There's math and music, but for him, there's also music and engineering. They help to increase the breadth of your ability to address issues that you're exploring and to share what you've learned with other people.
So you have done this, bringing science and art together through a blog that you write called Buzz Hoot Roar. And that led to a project that you're working on about brown recluses. So tell me about that.
Right. So we have a blog, Robin, who was in the car with me and has the business with me, and a woman named Sarah Blackman and a guy named Neil McCoy, and I have this blog. And what we do is we write peer-reviewed science explainers in 300 words or fewer, and then artists come in and illustrate what we've been saying. And one of the very first posts we did was called A Spider Did Not Bite You, because everybody knows somebody who they say is bitten by a brown recluse. And the data do not support what the doctor's diagnoses are saying. A lot of time they go back and look at it, and it's a MRSA infection. It's an antibiotic-resistant bacteria. That's, you know, and a lot of times the bites themselves do not have the effect that people are seeing, this melting away of your skin, right? So everybody, including people who are not from brown recluse areas, like here in North Carolina, are feeling like we are being bitten and besieged by brown recluses all the time. We're just not. And when we put that up, there's a western tip of North Carolina is in the brown recluses range, by the way. But even people who live with brown recluses, bites are extraordinarily rare. They're recluses. They're frightened of people. And so we put this post up, and people were coming in all the time, and they were like, you don't know what you're talking about. I was bitten. My mama died from a brown recluse bite. You know, they're really upset. And I was amazed by how upset they were by it. And so I joined forces with Matt Bertone, who's now the director of the plant disease insect or something identification clinic down at NC State. He's a wonderful taxonomist. He knows everything about everything in the world that's alive. And Catherine Scott from the University of Toronto, she's an arachnologist. And we wanted to see if they really were brown recluses in people's houses. So now, if you see a spider, you think it's a brown recluse, you take a picture of it, you tweet it to us, and somebody who knows how to identify things will identify it. And then we record where you're from, and we find out where the brown recluses are distributed across the country in ways that we've not ever been able to see before. And we're able to see what people are mistaking for brown recluses in a way that we were not able to see before. And what we found is that everything is mistaken for a brown recluse, even if it's green. They're called brown recluses. But even, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, every spider to many people is a brown recluse. We found them all across spider taxa. I think we've had 45 states submit it, and 19% of the spiders that were submitted were brown recluses. And these are spiders that people think are brown recluses that they're submitting, and 9% outside of their range. So these are people who've probably moved or had moving boxes and unpacked something, and then there's a spider there from a non-recluse, you know, from a recluse range to a non-recluse range. So we're finding all kinds of wonderful ideas, and we're also finding that people are paying attention to the spiders in their house, which is great because you're never more than 4 feet away from a spider.
Well, I remember you told us that last time you were on, and you also encouraged people that if a spider is living in your house, you should leave it there.
Leave it.
Part of, you know, keeping that habitat intact.
And right.
I'm curious about that because for me, there are some bugs that I see in my house that I can be totally fine with. Like, mm-hmm. I can be fine with little ants. I can be fine with a spider. But if I see a roach, mm-hmm. like, there's no part of me that doesn't think that needs to be killed.
Well, let's talk about roaches.
Okay, let's talk about
talk about pests.
Okay.
Okay? Well, let's talk about our houses first. You know, they've done studies here in the Raleigh area. Rob Dunn's lab and some wonderful researchers went and found every bug in everybody's house. And they found that people have up to 200 different species of arthropods living in their home. Different species, not different creatures. Okay?
Wow.
The average home had about 100 different species living in your house. Okay? So we think of roaches as very common. They were in only 6% of these homes, right? So pests make up a very small proportion of the insects or arthropods living in your house. What is everybody else doing there, right? I mean, they're wonderful things that they're doing there. They found little wasps that lay eggs on roach egg cases and eat the baby roaches alive. There's a huge ecosystem that we're living with, whether we know it or not, all the time in our house, and it's wonderful. Now, I will be with you on roaches.
Okay.
Okay, here's what I have to say for roaches. We have globally about 4,000 species of roaches that we know of, and about 5,000 that we haven't even named yet or found yet or gotten around to. And in North Carolina, I think in the United States, it's something like more than 50 species of roaches. But a very small number of those, 4 or 5 species, are pests. And a pest is anything that can cause economic damage or that can cause, is a health risk to you or is a nuisance to you. And roaches are all three. They bother us. They cost us money and that we have to treat for them, and they spoil things for us. And they cause a tremendous health risk for us. They have proteins on their bodies that trigger asthma, and they trigger allergic reactions. Mm. And so this is especially a problem in underserved communities, people who don't have the resources to take care of roaches, because asthma and allergies are the number one cause of school absenteeism in the country. And here we have this huge problem, and treating for roaches can be just as important as medication in these situations.
Wow.
So as far as roaches are concerned, inside the house, I'm totally with you. Outside, I say leave them.
Let them be.
They're doing stuff. They're doing incredible things in terms of turning our leaf matter into dirt that we can use. You know, they're a valuable part of our ecosystems. Outside, I don't want one in my house either.
So, we are interfering with many aspects of our climate, and I'm curious, from your perspective, what are we learning when we look at the bug world about humans' impact, and maybe tie this into climate change and what bugs are teaching us about the changing climate?
Let's talk about the bugs and changing climate, but first let's talk about the climate, the environment of North Carolina, because Here in North Carolina, we are part of what is called a global biodiversity hotspot, okay? We are one of the most, well, the eastern North Carolina and the south and parts of the southeast are one of the wealthiest places on the planet. There are only 36 of these places, 2.4% of the Earth's surface, and the environment there takes care of 35% of the ecological services that the rest of the world needs to survive. And we have that. We have one of the most abundant and rich places in the world to live. And when you're talking about taking care of stuff, a lot of these species are endemic to this area. That means that they don't live anywhere else. And so if we don't take care of those things, and we know that we're losing those things, no, they won't be anywhere ever again. And so other global biodiversity hotspots are like the tropical Andes or like the West African, you know, forest. I mean, these are incredible places, but so is North Carolina. It's an incredible place to be and to notice and to take care of things. Hmm. And we can see detrimental effects already on insects. Insects have always been used for like environmental testing. First of all, they are sensitive to temperature because they're cold-blooded, or if that's the word. And the other thing is that they are sensitive to other changes in the environment. So you can take a handful of insects out of a stream and tell if that stream is healthy or not based on who is able to live in that stream. So we've always tested that. But now we are seeing things that we've never seen before in the insect communities. We're seeing things that used to die in the winter that are overwintering. So you're finding yellow jacket nests down south the size of Volkswagen Beetles. Or you're seeing an extra generation per year because the warm season is longer. So we're seeing that like butterflies, there's an extra generation of butterflies. Isn't that nice? But also crop pests. There's an extra generation of crop pests. And we're also seeing things like carbon dioxide will increase the carbohydrates in plants. But the hot temperatures decrease the nitrogen in plants. Hmm. So insects are having to gobble up so much more plant material in order to survive. So not only are they active longer in the year, they're eating more. So these are things that we're going to have to contend with that we see right now. And because we've been studying insects for so long, we know that this stuff is new, that we haven't seen it before. So in terms of climate change, we are recognizing these things. In terms of environmentalism and what we can do, we need to pay attention and be proud of what we have here in North Carolina and work to keep it the way that it is. You know, we have something I met with Art Bogan, who's the mussel guy, the freshwater mollusk guy at the museum downtown last week. And he told me that we have something like 65 freshwater mollusk species. Do you ever think about those? I don't ever think about them. But they're cleaning our streams. And some of them you can't find anywhere else. They can live up to 200 years, some species. And they're hidden there in the mud doing stuff for us that we've never thought of. But we are taking away our streams. And when we do, we're wiping out these creatures that we'll never know about. And so it's important to be aware for each of us to pay attention to what we have around us. Because when you see it and you start to know it, you start to love it. And when you start to love something, you want to take care of it. And so that's, to me, insects are an easy way of seeing that. But it's not just insects. There are tons of different things that we can look at if you're interested in them in the natural world and fall in love with and work to keep the way that it is.
So on a real human level, you are a mother now. You're raising two young kids. How do you develop your own kind of family's code of ethics around the environment and the values you want to both instill in your kids and the way that you personally kind of try to make decisions that you feel like are in line with the kind of environmental future that you want to exist?
Well, the way that I try, the main way that I work not with my children to have an impact on the environment is I try to select candidates that I vote for that have our environment in mind when they are making decisions. And it doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on. There are people who recognize that we have a right to clean air and so that's a huge impact that you can have. But with the children, I just want them to know the natural world. And I'm really lucky because I'm an entomologist. So my hobbies are very much similar to the hobbies of a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. I mean, we're outside turning over logs all afternoon, and it's what I want to do. So it's what they're doing, and they like it. You know, I mean, they're not fascinated yet by yet. I'll turn them around. You know, we went to Bugfest at the museum last year, and my four-year-old said, oh, can we just go to the history museum, please? It's too many bugs. But, you know, I think I want them to be outside as much as possible, and I want them to think before they – I want this for everybody. I want you to think before you step on something. Wonder what it is before you're afraid of it, and maybe try to find out what it is, and then wonder what it's doing there. Because if you do that, you will be so surprised, maybe, or – to me, everything leads to another question, and everything leads to something beautiful.
We only have about a minute left, but yes. I want you to talk briefly about the educational books that you're writing and how you're trying to take all of your scientific knowledge and make it accessible to kids in public schools in North Carolina.
Oh, great. I'm working on a project with Rob Dunn at NC State University, and we're writing science, technology, engineering, arts, and math books where any child, including the children that I grew up with in Goldsboro, can pick up a book and they can work through a scientific problem using all of these concepts of art and math and science. And then at the end, they can go and participate in a citizen science project if they just have a computer. So maybe I didn't know what entomology was, but if I did, you know, all the other things you can discover. So these children can become, you know, work directly with archaeologists or work directly with, you know, people who are gazing up at the stars and measuring light pollution. No matter where you live, you can be in Wayne County and you can go and count animals on a wildlife reserve in Africa, you know, thinking about these ideas, no matter who you are. And I think that's one of the big deals about citizen science, because it's an equalizer. It doesn't matter how much money you have or what race you are, where you come from. If you have access to the internet, you can participate in these studies and you can learn the scientific process. So that's what we're working on right now. And I really look forward to seeing, or I just dream about the ideas that children are going to gain from participating in these studies. And I'm so thrilled about it.
Eleanor Spicer Rice is a senior science editor at Verdant Word and an entomologist. You can find out more about her work, see photos of some of the bugs we've talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. Eleanor, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That is The State of Things for today. It is a program produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.